My guest is Joan Didion. She's a novelist, journalist, and screenwriter whose writing provokes strong reactions. Writer Sarah Davidson described Didion as an articulate witness to the most stubborn and intractable truths of our time. But playwright John Lahr wrote that Didion and her husband share a narcissistic self-absorption and a love of luxury that make them brilliant mirrors of the California bourgeoisie. Didion's husband is the writer John Gregory Dunn, with whom she has collaborated on the screenplays for Panic in Needle Park, True Confessions, and Play It As It Lays, which is based on her novel of the same name. They also wrote the first drafts for the 1976 remake of A Star Is Born. Her books of essays, Slouching Toward Bethlehem and The White Album, cover subjects ranging from Haight-Ashbury in the 60s to the women's movement to shopping malls. The book also includes a series of reflections on her own life. Joan Didion's recent book, Salvador, was based on a 2-week encounter with that country. Her new book, Miami, looks at the Cuban-American community in Miami and its relationship to Cuba and to Washington politics. I spoke with Joan Didion earlier today from the NPR studios in New York. She told me how her observations of Miami are connected to her earlier work in El Salvador.
I had been interested in Miami for a long time before I started Salvador. There is a connection in that. It was when I went down to Salvador, I became immediately terribly aware of Miami because all of the Salvadorans who aren't living in Salvador, the rich Salvadorans, a lot of them are living in Miami. And so Miami is a place people are always talking about in Salvador. I remember talking to the president of, to the man who was then president of El Salvador, about Capital Flight out of El Salvador. And he kept saying things like, those people do not want to stay forever in Miami. And that seemed to be his only answer to the thing. So I became more interested in Miami.
Did you go down to Miami knowing what your story was going to be?
No. I knew that it had some connection with Latin America. But I didn't know exactly what or how to. I didn't know what my story was going to be till I was finished the book.
Well, how do you feel that you found your focus?
The same way I always do, just kind of working it through. I never know what I think about anything until I'm actually in it, until I'm actually writing it down. Right away in Miami, I started talking to Cubans. I talked to very few, comparatively few non-Cubans. It was clear to me that was the community that gave the city its particular flavor, and that was the community that had the relationship with Washington. I mean, Miami, really, as it exists today, is a product of American foreign policy in a way that no other American city is.
I get the impression from your book that a lot of the Cuban exiles living in Miami still feel betrayed by the Kennedy administration for the failure of the Bay of Pigs invasion.
They feel betrayed by the Kennedy administration. They feel betrayed by every administration, up, including the present one, but particularly the Kennedy administration because of the Bay of Pigs and because of the agreement at the time of the missile crisis. Kennedy agreed not to invade Cuba, which was a big blow to Cuban Miami.
What kind of reaction did you find among the Cubans to the Reagan administration?
Well, the Cubans in Miami, those who are citizens and vote, have voted twice overwhelmingly for Reagan, more strongly even in 84 than in 80. I think 92% of them in 84 voted for Reagan, and they are not all registered Republicans. This included Democrats voted for Reagan. Everybody voted for Reagan. They, at the same time, simultaneously, they did not trust him. They constantly talked about the deal he was going to make. They believed that he would, like every other American president, sell them out when the time came when the United States saw that an advantage to itself in making a deal with Castro. I mean, they anticipated being sold out.
Did you find a lot of Contra support activities in Miami?
They are very, almost universally, very strong supporters of the Contras, and both in terms of action. I mean, they actually, a lot of them, or some of them, go down to help the Contras. There are a lot of, and then a lot of people have supported them financially, and everybody supports them rhetorically.
One of the recurring observations that you came across was that a lot of the Cubans kept telling you that they thought Americans exhibited a certain lack of passion, as epitomized by Ted Koppel and the Nightline show. I thought that was pretty funny, actually.
I couldn't understand what was going on when people first started. Everybody would mention Ted Koppel to me as evidence of how passionless Anglos were. And it wasn't Ted Koppel himself as much as Ted Koppel, the show, the Nightline. They all couldn't get over. They watched it just in wonderment that people could talk to each other. People with opposing point of views could talk to each other without coming to high pitched argument or to blows. It didn't seem and could continue talking to each other and not walk off. And it was construed as most un-Cuban behavior and not really very admirable.
Do you think that you were seen as passionless, too, by the people you were interviewing?
I'm sure, yeah.
My guest is writer Joan Didion, and her latest book is titled Miami. You wrote an essay in the 1960s in which you were talking about your approach as a reporter, and you said, my only advantage as a reporter is that I am so physically small, so temperamentally unobtrusive, so neurotically inarticulate, that people tend to forget that my presence runs counter to their best interests. Does that still describe you as a reporter?
Yes. I'm not a good interviewer, and I'm not very aggressive in a situation. I tend to just kind of have to hang around the edges of it and see what's going on.
Do you think that being small and physically unobtrusive makes people more
less
wary of you? Less suspicious?
Wary. They think that I am not a threat to anyone.
Do you exploit that in any way?
I use it. I wouldn't say that I exploit it. In fact, I'm always pretty careful to, as most reporters are, to go in with a notebook, to go in with a tape recorder, to go in making sure that everybody knows what you're there for.
In another essay in your book, The White Album, you described yourself as a woman who feels radically separated from the ideas that interest other people. You wrote that you felt like a sleepwalker moving through the world, unconscious of the moment's high issues, alert only to the stuff of bad dreams, and that acquaintances would read the New York Times and try to tell you the news, but you wouldn't read the newspapers yourself. I wonder if that's changed at all, especially as you've done more reporting.
I read the newspapers a lot, but I still, I read four or five newspapers a day, but I am still more interested in the in what's not in the newspapers. I mean, it is kind of astonishing to me how much stuff goes on that is generally not covered.
What kinds of stories do you mean? Or what kind of issues?
Well, let's look at Miami. It was well known to everyone in Miami that there was stuff going on, there was support going on, that there was a Contra supply network being run out of Miami. It started being talked about in the Miami Herald in 1985. It was not talked about in other papers in this country.
Why did you start reading the newspapers? When? What? Why? Because apparently you didn't used to read them.
I started reading them when. Well, I did read them. I just wasn't very engaged in them. I became engaged in them one morning. It was during the Vietnam War, when I picked up the paper and read something that was exactly the opposite of it. It was a statement from someone about it. There had been all week an effort to obtain or hold a particular position, and it had been very bloody. It had been at great cost of men. And eventually the position had been obtained and was being held by the Americans. At this moment, there was an announcement that there was going to be a withdrawal or from this position because it was not strategic. Well, I don't know what I. It seemed to me that somebody was not telling me the whole story there. And so I started reading the papers very, very closely, because I kept noticing that if you actually read the papers very closely, there was a whole lot of, the whole lot of the story wasn't there.
How would you describe what you're trying to do in comparison with daily journalism in newspapers?
Well, what I do is just try to sort of go someplace and try to kind of put things together just pull some threads together rather than cover breaking events. I think it would be very hard for me to cover breaking events, and I'm not very interested in breaking events.
Reporting brings you face to face with a world. Reporting brings you face-to-face with the world in a way that writing fiction doesn't. Because in fiction, you encounter the world in your imagination. In journalism, you have to actually physically be there, too.
yeah, it's kind of a help. it's a help to me to be able to go out into the world.
Is that one of the reasons why you write journalism, to kind of get you out there?
Yeah, it's awful to get up every morning and just have to make up the world all over again. I mean, it's very... Some mornings you just don't feel like it.
You wrote in one of your essays that you had a nervous breakdown in 1968, and you even reprint some of what the doctor wrote about you, and he wrote that you had alienated yourself almost entirely from the world of human beings. I'm not sure what he meant by that. What did he mean?
I don't know what he meant. I was astonished by it. It seemed to me a very odd report. I didn't actually have a breakdown. I went to a doctor, but I mean, I wasn't hospitalized. I think maybe a lot of it, what he was seeing was actually a lot of it came out of a novel I was writing at the time. I was writing Play It As It Lays. And I think possibly that a lot of my reactions to questions asked me by a psychiatrist came out of that mood rather than my own. I mean, you are, for one thing, you are, when you're writing a novel, alienated from the world of other human beings.
In the sense that you're sitting home?
You just have these imaginary playmates who you spend the day with. And once you're deeply into it, you kind of resent it when you have to go out and go out to dinner and talk to other people. I mean, you find them in an intrusion into this imaginary world. It's a peculiar hazard of writing novels.
So what kind of balance do you like to keep now between novels and journalism and essays?
I have to go back to writing a novel now. Sometimes it's not time. Sometimes you just don't feel like writing a novel. Now I have to go back and to a novel that I have been avoiding for a while.
Would you say what it's about, or would you rather not?
I'd rather not.
That's fine, yeah.
Just superstition.
Yeah, no, I understand. Yeah. My guest is Joan Didion. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. Joan Didion's new book is titled Miami. This is Fresh Air. Writer Joan Didion is my guest. She's joining us from the NPR Bureau in New York. You wrote once that whenever you walk into a room, a sentence goes through your head. It's a sentence that Jessica Mitford's governess used to tell her, and that is, remember, you're the least important person in this room, and don't forget it.
Exactly.
What a really self-effacing thing to be carrying around all the time.
It is just what I think of when I walk into a room. It's not necessarily a bad thing.
Well, why do you think of that?
I think it's true. Maybe all writers think that it's because you're focused on watching other people, and rather than on their watching you.
Were you brought up to be self-effacing?
I don't.
Or to think of yourself as less important than others?
No, actually, my father was always telling me how important I was, and he often has said to me that I have a deep-seated superiority complex, which may be true, but in a social situation, I tend to not be very. To be less interested in my own role in it than in everybody else, the interaction among the other people.
Is it easy to still feel like the least important person in the room when you're as well known as you've become?
Well, I never think of myself as well known. I think of myself as barely noticeable. So, yeah, anyway, I'm not well known I live in Los Angeles.
Oh, where everybody's a star.
I am not well known in Los Angeles, so that's a. If I ever presumed to think that I was well known in Los Angeles, I would quickly be set straight. So it's a very different atmosphere. I have a whole different fix on
fame.
Yeah.
You suffer from migraine headaches, which leave you incapacitated for about 3 to 5 days a month. Are they connected to writing?
No, they're connected to not writing. They're connected to, if I could connect them to any, what they're connected to is some kind of chemical flaw or vascular hereditary thing. But what actually brings them on or triggers them is always not working. It's doing things like losing the laundry or going to the dentist and having a lot of little confusing things that end up not doing anything, end up in days that don't produce anything. I mean, the actual rhythm of working is for me very, very soothing and makes me feel good.
Because focusing on what you're writing enables you to block out all the other chaos of life?
Yeah, I have kind of a simple one-track mind. Actually, I can't handle a whole lot of things going on the edges. And so the simpler the day is, the better off I am.
Do you get a lot of advice that you could live without about how to handle your migraines?
I get a lot of diets.
Oh, really?
Yeah, people send me diets. And names of allergists and things. But actually, I kind of have come to terms with it. I mean, when I get one, I usually kind of recognize that it's time to spend a day in bed and refocus.
Have you ever gotten a migraine while you were outside of the country, reporting, for instance, while you were in Salvador?
I never got a migraine in Salvador, and I never got a migraine in any kind of dangerous situation. or any kind of situation that is where, no, I think you wouldn't. I think in a way that you unconsciously time them for times when you can afford to have one.
I guess that's reassuring. Otherwise, it might be really frightening to go to any kind of dangerous place.
It would be frightening to feel as, you know, because you feel quite helpless if you are having any kind of total illness, which is what migraine is. I mean, it totally incapacitates you for the short time you have it. And you certainly would not want to be incapacitated the only other country in the world I've ever gotten a migraine in is Paris. I mean, it's France, so where I feel perfectly, of course, safe.
Perhaps this is a stupid question, but did you ever get an idea while you were suffering with a migraine?
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's a terrific, after the actual, when it starts to break, you know, there are several hours when it's just taking a while to go away, but you don't feel entirely unconscious anymore. I just lie there and think about things. And you think about, you just kind of refocus things.
Your husband is also a writer, John Gregory Dunn, and you've collaborated on several screenplays together. You also write your own novels and essays. Did you ever go someplace together or share an experience together where you both wanted to write about it, but only one of you could do it? Has that ever happened?
No, it hasn't. We kind of... maybe the decision is made early on, and maybe we just automatically defer to the person who has the strongest or earlier interest. I don't know how it happens, but at any given time we will see things in different ways, and so we'll use things differently. He did not go to Miami with me, except he went down once, I think. He had no interest in Miami. We were in Salvador together, and when we went down, we did not know who was going to write about it or if anybody was going to write about it. And then as the days went on, it kind of became clear that the notes I was making were toward writing something kind of immediate and a reporting thing, and that the notes he was making were in the direction of using it in some way in a novel he was working on, which he did. He used some of the stuff, the Salvador stuff from that trip in a book in The Red, White, and Blue, which was published last spring.
Would he ever look at your notes and say, I was there, that's not the way it happened?
No, our notes are totally different. I mean, we will take different notes on the same situation.
So you perceive the same situation very differently?
Well, we just pick up on different things. Sometimes if we're in a meeting together, I'll write down the dialogue and he'll write down the other stuff, sometimes vice versa. But we almost never, there was almost no duplication in our Salvador notes. And although we were together all the time.
Do you show each other work in progress?
Yeah, we do. He is my first reader. I am his first reader. We show each other, he shows me about every chapter of something, and I show him at longer intervals or when I'm having trouble.
Are you ever self-conscious about your husband reading your first draft, which is the rawest copy? Do you ever feel like you don't want him to see this?
No, well, my first drafts aren't so raw.
Well, that's true. You probably really rework them a lot. Yeah.
But I'd show him, he will see the early, I mean, for Miami, for example, he saw, when I was trying to start it, I showed him the first 12 pages. Now, the first 12 pages that I showed him had the lead, had the very beginning of what is now the beginning of the book. And then it had just sentences, which really I noticed when I was throwing my notes in a box when I was finished with it, really had, they were really more like an outline for the entire book than it was copy. So obviously it didn't read well at all, which he pointed out. and said that I needed to open it up. Well, I know what he means by open it up. He means take some time, you know.
Your daughter is a photographer now, right?
She's still at Barnard, but she is a photographer. Yes.
I find it interesting that she gravitated toward a visual form of expression, mm-hmm. coming from a family that is totally preoccupied with words.
Yeah. Well, she's majoring in philosophy, so
she's not leaving words behind altogether.
No.
Can I ask you briefly before we run out of time if you had people encourage you in your writing when you were young?
Yes. Yes, I did. Teachers were very encouraging. From the time I was a little girl.
What's the kind of things that teachers would say that would make you think, well, this is interesting, I'll pursue this, I can do this, I like this?
They would just encourage me. I can't remember any specific things, but it was very valuable to me. I mean, I remember specific teachers who gave me to understand that I could do something that not all people could do, which was very encouraging because I was a very shy child who without much confidence.
Will you be writing any more screenplays in the near future?
Yeah, we're writing a screenplay now.
Really? What's it about? Or should I not ask that?
It's an original screenplay for Lorimar, and it's about... it takes place in Los Angeles in the years immediately after World War II, when there was a kind of boom and there were a lot of gangsters around, and the movie business was, you know, it's in that period. So the story is of no, you know, we're still working out the details of the story. But
okay. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your writing. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you.
My guest has been journalist, novelist, and screenwriter Joan Didion. Her latest book, Miami, has just been published by Simon & Schuster. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.